On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Dr. Lena Wen joins us for this month's edition of Health Watch, the Zika virus. What have we learned as we watch the greater Miami area struggle to contain this sometimes fatal disease? And how do you assign value to something that didn't happen? Safe streets may have diffused as many as 700 conflicts in the last 9 years. Governor Larry Hogan has proposed cutting this program by about $1 million. Lena Wen on the status of safe streets. Then, unconstitutional conduct by the Baltimore Police Department. Commissioner Kevin Davis responds to the scathing Department of Justice report. Kevin Reck of the Baltimore Sun puts it in context, and Lynn Bowie of the Washington Post on how the consent decree to reform the Prince George's County Police Department has worked. Plus, Ben Jealous, the former head of the NAACP, squares the DOJ report with recommendations for police reform he proffered 10 months ago. First, the news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
I'm Tom Hall. Again, glad you're with us. We're going to start today with our monthly Health Watch feature. Dr. Lena Wen joins me again in Studio A. She is Baltimore City's Health Commissioner. Good morning, Lena. It's always good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So we've got a very hot day today, a hot day tomorrow, and I understand that just within the last 15 minutes, you've declared another code red advisory, not just for today and tomorrow, but for Sunday. So we are in for a long weekend, aren't we?
Absolutely. And people need to know that heat is one of our leading killers when it comes to weather-related emergencies. It's not just cold weather that's dangerous. Hot weather is extremely dangerous, too.
The cooling centers are also open now. When folks use the term heat stroke, what does that mean? What are the symptoms? I mean, if we're living in a house with an older person or young, very young children, the ones who are most susceptible to problems with heat and dehydration, what should we be on the lookout for?
Think about not just the term heat stroke, but hyperthermia, which is high body heat. Heat stroke is an extreme version of that. But even before one gets to heat stroke, people should be on the lookout for signs and symptoms. So especially for children, for the elderly, for others who are medically frail, watch for symptoms like nausea, dizziness, confusion. People can sometimes get dry mouth and they feel that their hearts are beating more quickly. But watch for those symptoms. Make sure that people stay indoors in air conditioning as much as possible. Limit the time outdoors. Sometimes kids can go out and play and not realize that they've been in the sun and then come back really dehydrated. Hydration, very important. Don't drink alcohol, which can blunt your senses when it comes to going, knowing that something is wrong. And very importantly, never leave your pets, never leave your children in a car, even if it's for just a few seconds, because the inside of the car heats up very rapidly. And unfortunately, every year, our animal control officers at the health department find pets that die. And there have been kids who have died of hyperthermia as well.
Sure. And if you're in a neighborhood, you know that you have a neighbor, particularly an elderly neighbor, maybe she doesn't have air conditioning, something like that, you know, try to do what you can to help. If you've got air conditioning, have her over, you know, or maybe help her get to one of the cooling centers, or, you know, just keep an eye on folks. But hydration is really the key, isn't it? People just have to drink lots and lots of water.
Hydration is very important. And as you said, watching out for those around us who are the most vulnerable, this is as good of a time as any to be a good neighbor, because it does require all of us to keep our community healthy and safe.
Indeed. So let's talk about Zika prevention. Big news in Miami and the greater Miami area this last week. More than 20 reported cases of locally transmitted Zika in Florida. It's interesting to me that it seems to be incredibly contained. It's like within like a mile, square mile radius. How does that? I mean, mosquitoes are all over the place.
Mosquitoes.
How's that work?
You know, mosquitoes are all over the place, but the Aedes mosquito, the mosquito that carries Zika, lives in an area just 100 feet away. And so the mosquito itself is not going to be traveling. The Zika-infested mosquito is not going to be traveling miles, certainly is not going to travel all the way up to a different state. The issue, though, is that we have been anticipating local transmission of Zika for months. This is the reason why Mayor Rawlings Blake asked for me to head up the citywide Zika task force, why we've had all of our city agencies involved for months. We've been coordinating with our state and federal partners for months because we knew that local transmission, according to the CDC, was likely to happen. Now it's happened in Florida, which means that it's not just cases of people who've traveled to other countries who've brought it back who are getting Zika. It's also people who haven't had any travel at all who are affected. And the concern about Zika is not for the average person. It's for the pregnant woman because of the possibility of birth defect in the unborn child. There have been over 57 cases of Zika in Maryland, all that are travel associated. But I want to remind our listeners that it's not just Zika that mosquitoes can carry. Mosquitoes carry all kinds of other illnesses like West Nile and dengue and chikungunya and other illnesses too. And so it's really important for everyone to get rid of standing water. Something as small
sometimes
as
even as a bottle cap, people have been saying. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and there are unsuspecting things in the yard that can collect standing water. So Tupperware containers, pet dishes, flower pots, trash cans. Make sure that you empty standing water because that's the best thing that we can do to protect our neighbors. And this is also a good time to be a good neighbor and check on your neighbors' yards, too.
The city has been spraying as well in particular areas. How are you identifying the areas that need to be sprayed, and what should the folks in those areas be aware of?
We identify the areas that need spraying based on the guidelines set by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and in coordination with our other city and state agencies. Some of the reasons we spray include around cases of individuals who have Zika and depending on the surveillance that we have for mosquitoes that are in the area. We have traps that are around the city looking at what types of mosquitoes there are. And when we do spraying, we notify residents in advance by going door to door. Our outreach workers and volunteers go door to door, and we do reverse 911 messages. So people get phone calls at home alerting them about when that spraying is to take place.
And if the spraying is taking place, you know, are there any particular precautions that folks should do? Should they stay inside, keep the windows closed,
yes,
the air conditioning on?
Individuals are recommended to stay indoors and also to bring specific items indoors. For example, pets and children certainly should not be playing outside during that time. And pet dishes and children's toys should be moved inside for the 1 to 2 hours around the time of spraying as well.
So the actual spraying is a somewhat dangerous time. I don't want to use the word dangerous if that's too strong a term, but do people have anything to worry about after the spraying has been done? I mean, these are chemicals we're throwing out there, and people obviously have a sort of knee-jerk reaction to safety when it comes to that.
Everything that we do in medicine and public health is about cost and benefit. There is a risk to every single intervention that we have, no matter if it's a medication or a procedure or anything. And that's why we're so careful in monitoring in advance of why it is that we need to spray. And we look at the risks and benefits to doing the spraying. And so please, if you get a phone call from us, if you get outreach workers visiting you, please follow our instructions. But also everyone in the city should be reassured that we are ready for Zika, that we have been preparing for this for months, and that this is something that we expected to happen. Now, it's unfortunate that Congress still has not appropriated the amount that that President Obama, that the CDC have been asking for. Zika is a crisis in slow motion. For everything in public health, it's hard to measure the value because we're preventing something from happening. But we can't just look at the cost of a program. We also have to look at the cost of doing nothing and the cost of having a child born with severe birth defects in our city and around the country is unconscionable and significant when it comes to economic impact. And so we have to look at that, too.
Yeah, Department of Health and Human Services and the Obama administration just a couple days ago announced that they were diverting about $81 million from other programs into research to develop a Zika vaccine. But, of course, where does that leave those other programs? It's not that those are unimportant programs.
same thing that we're seeing in the city as well. We have had to divert our resources to fight Zika, something we feel strongly about doing because it is a public health emergency. But so is the opioid crisis. So is lead poisoning. So is HIV. And so it's important for us to get additional resources so that we can improve the health of our residents and reduce the already rampant disparities.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, the city's health commissioner here in Baltimore City. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Speaking of opioids, you have an overdose awareness day happening in a couple of weeks on the 31st of August. What's that going to include?
There are more people in our city dying from overdose than there are from homicide. From our standpoint, it is critical that everyone is involved in stopping overdoses because there's something that we can all do today. The people that are affected by addiction and overdose, they're not random people. They are residents. They are our neighbors. They are family members. They are community members. Everyone can learn to use naloxone or Narcan to save a life. We'll be having trainings all across our city for those individuals who are interested in volunteering. We still have many slots open for volunteers to join our staff in training. So please contact us at health.baltimorecity.gov and sign up to be a volunteer. We have a number of commemorative events, of awareness-raising events throughout our city. And August 31st is Overdose Awareness Day. We hope that everyone will join us in that.
Because you would really like everybody, all of us, to know, for example, how to administer naloxone in case we have a family member or a neighbor who has an addiction episode and is overdosed. I mean, this is not something that you want to just confine to people who are addicts or confine to the people who are caring for addicts, right? It's that big a problem, in other words. You think we should all know about it, even if at the moment we may not have anyone in our lives that's dealing with this.
Frankly, we don't know if we have someone in our lives who has an addiction. Addiction, unfortunately, is so heavily stigmatized. People are functioning addicts for a long time. And if we can all save a life, then why not? And there is something, so we can do the training right here in 20 seconds. It's that easy for us to be able to do. If a person is overdosing, they can't save their own life because they're unresponsive and not breathing. That's why there's something that each of us can do to save a life. You can go to don'tdie.org right now and learn to use naloxone and even get a prescription for it right now. And we urge everyone to do so and to join us on August 31st.
Don'tdie.org. I don't know. I got mixed feelings about that website, but we do need to get people to go.
It's a strong message, and people are dying every single day in our city from overdose.
Indeed. All right, Dr. Lena Nguyen, always good to see you. We'll see you next time. Thanks
so
much.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is Baltimore City's health commissioner. She joins us each month for our Health Watch series. We'll have a link to the Baltimore City Health Department website at our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That'll include information about Opioid Awareness Day on August 31st. Coming up after a break for the news, we examine the damning report by the Department of Justice about the pattern and practice of conduct in the Baltimore Police Department. We'll talk about it with Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun, Lynn Bowie of the Washington Post, Ben Jealous of the Center for American Progress, and Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
We conclude that there is reasonable cause to believe that BPD engages in a pattern or practice of conduct that violates the Constitution and federal anti-discrimination law. BPD engages in a pattern or practice of making unconstitutional stops, searches, and arrests, using enforcement strategies that produce severe and unjustified disparities in the rates of stops, searches, and arrests of African Americans, using excessive force, and retaliating against people engaging in constitutionally protected expression. These violations have deeply eroded the mutual trust between BPD and the community it serves.
That's the head of the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, Vinita Gupta, speaking about the report issued last week by the Department of Justice in which they describe systemic deficiencies, repeated violations of the Constitution, and bias against African Americans in the Baltimore Police Department. Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to examine this issue in several ways. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk to Ben Jealous, the former president of the NAACP and now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Last October, he was the lead author of a report called Toward Trust, Grassroots Recommendations for Police Reform in Baltimore. Also, Kevin Rector is a reporter with the Baltimore Sun who has written extensively about the Baltimore police and the courts. He joins me here in the studio. And one of the next steps in the process of police reform is for the city and the Department of Justice to negotiate a consent decree that requires the police to address the multiple problems described in the DOJ report. So how effective have consent decrees been in other jurisdictions? Lynn Bowie of the Washington Post will join us as well. She's covered consent decrees in, among other places, Prince George's County. But first, joining us on the phone is Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis, who coincidentally was on the Prince George's County Police Force while the consent decrees were in place there. Good morning, Commissioner. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Good morning, Tom, and good morning to Kevin Rector as well. And I'm glad you're talking to Lynn Bowie because the consent decree experience in Prince George's really changed our relationship with the community. So I'm glad you're talking to her.
Yeah, we will look forward to that conversation. Indeed, I got to tell you, sir, the thing that struck me about this report was the discrepancy between the report's contention that the problems in the Baltimore Police Department are so pervasive and your continued contention, as well as the contention of Mayor Rawlings Blake and people like Senator Pugh and even Congressman Cummings, you all are contending that the problem really still lies with a small number of bad apples, a small percentage of people on the force who are acting without integrity. To read the report, it's difficult to imagine how a small number of people can commit unconstitutional acts with the pervasiveness that the report describes. Can you explain how that is?
Sure, Tom. And I think it takes a lot of thought and hard work to really look at what the report is saying. Now, the Department of Justice came here because the mayor asked them to come here. Now, that is absolutely unique and something that we shouldn't gloss over. She suspected that this was the case within her police department, and she asked DOJ Civil Rights to come in to help make us better. But when the report describes egregious acts of misconduct, and it does, I assign that to a small number of police officers. Now, when the report also describes enforcement strategies, and the clip that you played with Vinita Gupta describing long-standing enforcement strategies that the BPD has adopted over the last couple of decades, the police officers who have been compelled by political and police leadership to engage in those policing strategies aren't necessarily bad apples. So there's two different conversations. You have police officers who intentionally engage in criminal misconduct. That's one. And then you have police officers that have been the victim of failed policing strategies. They, in and of themselves, are not bad apples. And I think that's worth some conversation. So I still contend and believe with all my heart that the vast majority of Baltimore police officers consistently come to work each and every day and do the right thing. I think it's too easy to look at that contention that I make and represent that I'm somehow wrong now because of this report. I'm not. I realize the difference between the two, and I think Baltimoreans realize the difference between the two.
The mayor has estimated that it could cost the city $5 to $10 million a year to satisfy the requirements that might be negotiated in a consent decree. In Los Angeles, over a 12-year period, they spent about $300 million. How does $5 or $10 or $20 million a year fix the culture and fix those problems that you've just identified with policing approaches, policing techniques being foisted upon the rank and file, that kind of thing? How does money fix that? What are you going to spend that money on?
Well, money goes toward training and technology, and better trained cops interact in a more constitutional, respectful way with the community. And money also brings much-needed technology to the nation's eighth-largest police department that better prepares police officers to engage in policing strategies that are based on data and not on hunches and suspicions and street corners. So it costs money to run a big-time police department like Baltimore, and forever, the training and technology commitment within this agency has been anemic at best. The inside of a Baltimore police car, and I know Kevin Rector knows this, looks like the inside of my first police car in 1992. There's been no commitment to technology to better prepare police officers to do their job, and there's been little to no commitment to training. We've been a one-dimensional police department for too long. We've engaged in some failed enforcement strategies, and we're at a point now where we know we have to fix it, and this pending consent decree with DOJ will compel and mandate those improvements.
I wonder why it is that the progress in some seemingly easy areas to address appears to be pretty slow. One of the things that the report talks about is seat belting in the vans. This is, of course, something that's been on everybody's minds during the trials that, you know, the first hung jury happened last December. It's been many months. But they're saying that perhaps as many as 20% or more of the people polled by the Department of Justice said that they were unsecured when they were put in the van. Right. 10 months later, how could that be?
Well, Tom and Kevin, let's talk about that for a second, because I recently conducted a surprise inspection at Central Booking where investigators from Internal Affairs inspected all of the incoming prisoner transport wagons, and the compliance rate was 100%. Now, I read the DOJ report where they report that they polled anonymously criminal defendants at a bail review hearing. And when they polled those criminal defendants at a bail review hearing, they asked them if they were seatbelted in the prisoner transport wagon after they were arrested. And their report indicates that up to 20% of them anonymously responded that they were not seatbelted. Now, I would argue that that is very unscientific. So what I'm going to continue to do is inspect what I expect of my police department, and that inspection will be hands-on, eyes-on with the prisoner transport wagons as they arrive at Central Booking and as they otherwise transport prisoners in the city. It's very, very important to me. We've recently amended our use of force policy that speaks to many, many things, to include prisoner transport. And while I understand that anonymous poll that DOJ took at a bail review hearing, I'm just not too sure that that's too terribly scientific, but I'm going to continue to inspect it within my agency.
All right, Commissioner, I know you have to go this morning, but let me ask you one more question, and that is, what do you think the effect on the street to the rank-and-file police force in Baltimore is going to be now that this report has been made public?
Well, Tom, I met with Anita Gupta and her staff, with the executive command staff the day of the DOJ announcement. It was a very robust conversation. Very healthy conversation. I met yesterday with my command staff, the captains and majors and above, and that was a very healthy conversation. Today I'm meeting with my sergeant's advisory board, and to a person, and I mean this without exception, everyone is looking forward to how this relationship with the DOJ and the consent decree can make us a better police department. And I speak quite often throughout the last year with the rank and file here and the commanders about my experience with DOJ and a consent decree in Prince George's County. And it made us better with the community, and it simultaneously made us better at the crime fight. So to the critics out there, and there are some critics who seem to think that a DOJ consent decree will have a negative effect on our capacity to police effectively, I can tell you from my own personal experience that that's just not the case. It'll sharpen our crime fight, and it will certainly make us better in our relationship with the community, and it will compel and mandate those changes. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to it, and we're going to roll up our sleeves and get it done.
All right. Well, Commissioner, I know you're busy this morning. You got to run, but thank you for your time, and we will look forward to having you back soon to continue this conversation. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks, Kevin.
So, Kevin Rector, turning to you, the community was not surprised by this report. I mean, most folks, particularly in communities of color, say this is our lived experience. We've been dealing with this for as long as we can remember. Were you surprised by anything in this report? I mean, you've been covering this for a long time, and you know it as well or better than anybody in town.
It's a good question. I certainly was not surprised by a good number of things in the report. The Baltimore Sun's reporting has borne out some of these things for years. I was a bit surprised by the scope of the findings. And I think, like many people in Baltimore, taken aback a bit by some of the most egregious actions that they laid out.
What about this, the bad apple theory, that it really is, as the commissioner continues to contend, just a small percentage of people? Or is that what you're hearing from folks on the force? Is that what you're hearing from people on the street?
That question is one I put to the commissioner on Wednesday as well. It's a question that I hear from a lot of people on the street. They don't believe that it's just a handful of bad apples. I think the report speaks to the systemic nature of the problems in the police department. And I don't know. I don't know if it's looking at the same thing in two different ways by saying it's bad apples and the rest of the police just don't know how to constitutionally police. And on the other side saying, the whole police department is rotten.
It's somewhere in between. Yeah.
It begs the question. I mean, obviously we're speaking in metaphors here, but what is a bad apple? I mean, if you don't have bad intent or malicious intent necessarily, but you're going around jacking people up on Baltimore streets without cause, are you a bad apple or not? I don't know.
Let me welcome Lynn Bowie into the conversation. Lynn is a reporter for The Washington Post. Lynn, good morning. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The next step, now that the city of Baltimore and the Department of Justice have reached an agreement in principle, is to develop a consent decree. What has the experience in Prince George's County? You've written about this as well as consent decrees in other places around the country. How has that worked? Has it been effective? Do people think that, in fact, this was a good way of addressing the problems they identified in PG County?
Yeah, so in the 2000s, the county, you know, had Department of Justice intervention for these excessive canine bites. Hundreds of bites in a 7-year period, 800 bites to be more specific. And that issued a consent, that prompted a consent decree. But then there was also a separate agreement that included a review of shootings as well. So these two sort of separate agreements forced everyone to not just modernize the department, but then they also looked at general orders and basically rewrote the department's policies through this time span. And after about 5 years of monitoring, the Department of Justice left, and largely everyone says they've come out a very different department. The NAACP over in the county says that their complaints of force went from maybe 10 to 15 calls a month to now one or two. And in speaking with the current police chief, Hank Stawinski, over there, who was part of the team that rewrote policies during Department of Justice review, he said it allowed the department to find efficiencies to not only improve policies, but then those efficiencies allowed them to better focus on the crime fight and, protecting the community, which is what the police department wants to do.
And Kevin Rector, this notion of accountability, I mean, when you talk to the beat cops, when you talk to the folks in the courts, when you talk to people on the street, do you think that the consent decree would be able to enable the department to have officers be more accountable and have data collected that can prove whether or not they're doing what they're saying they're doing?
I think a sentiment I hear a lot is that the Baltimore Police Department is woefully ill-equipped technology-wise. And I think that a lot of people believe that when they start bringing in new technology, putting computers in all the patrol cars, things like that, that there will be a benefit there. But in terms of accountability, I think it's a question that's up in the air. The ACLU of Maryland sued the Baltimore Police Department in 2006, reached an agreement in 2010 that was supposed to address a lot of these unconstitutional stops. We did see arrests come down dramatically in Baltimore, but the data in this new DOJ report is from 2010 to 2015, largely, which is entirely after, or mostly after, the ACLU's agreement with the city went into effect. And what the report shows is that these unconstitutional stops were still happening all over the place. So in terms of whether this consent decree will be different, will hold the police department's feet to the fire, is yet to be seen.
Yeah, and Lynn Bowie, we just have about 30 seconds left. I mean, you talk about the data that suggests things are working, you know, number of complaints down from 15 to 1. But what about the culture? I mean, do people have a palpable sense that the culture of the PG Police Department has changed?
I think, you know, a lot of people in the community think that the trust between the community and the police department has dramatically turned around. I mean, obviously, you know, people will point to continued concerns, but, you know, the NAACP largely has a great relationship with the police department. I think with the work after, you know, something like this that happens over years, is you have to keep it up. You know, once the DOJ leaves, once the court ordered,
right, you got to follow through. Yeah, Lynn Bowie, I'm sorry, that's all the time we have. I appreciate your time and your reporting this morning. Thank you so much, as well as Kevin Rector. Kevin Rector, a writer with the Baltimore Sun, Lynn Bowie with the Washington Post. Coming up after a break for the news, Ben Jealous, former president of the NAACP and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, joins me here on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. More on the DOJ report in the Baltimore Police Department after the news. First, it's time for a Baltimore story with Gil Sandler.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
We have revised 26 key policies, including the department's important use of force policy. We're now training all of our officers on these new policies, and we've held additional trainings on key issues that the Justice Department has identified. We are revamping our approach to officer accountability, including the way that the use of force by officers is reviewed and how officers are disciplined. A number of initiatives are underway to improve the police department's transparency and to encourage officers to actively engage with the communities that they serve.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the report issued on Wednesday by the Department of Justice at the request of the mayor and the police department about what the report calls systemic deficiencies and a pattern of unconstitutional behavior by Baltimore police. That was Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake speaking at a press conference on Wednesday. We hope to speak soon with Ben Jealous, the former head of the NAACP. We're having a little technical difficulty getting in touch with Ben, but in the meantime, Kevin Rector, reporter for the Baltimore Sun, is still with me here in Studio A. Kevin, there are a couple of things about this report that were very surprising to me. One was the fact that Baltimore police sometimes conduct public strip searches. They're taking people's clothes off in the middle of the street in front of their neighbors and in the communities in which they live. That's amazing to me. What did you learn about that practice from this report and from your reporting?
We'd heard of similar situations in the past, and this report confirms that, and you know, puts it in black and white. And it's one of the more egregious things in the report. You can't imagine having that done to you, particularly under the circumstances outlined in the report, which is essentially that they had no reason to even stop the person. It seems like pure harassment and an egregious form of it on the street. One young man had his pants and boxers pulled down in front of his girlfriend on the street. I mean, that is the type of conduct that I think jumps out at people who read this report in Baltimore and say, what's being done? On Wednesday, when the mayor and the commissioner and Vinita Gupta with the Civil Rights Division at the DOJ had a news conference, the commissioner mentioned terminations that he'd made of officers this year. Some people misunderstood that to mean that it was as a result of the DOJ report. Working the beat locally, I knew that wasn't the case. I clarified it with him later that day. He said that, in fact, eight officers have been terminated in the last year under his watch, but none of those terminations have come as a result of the DOJ report. I asked him whether he was looking into the more egregious actions outlined in the report and whether that would result in further investigation and any future terminations of officers. He said that he was looking into the report. He said at the time, this was again Wednesday, that he hadn't read it with a fine-tooth comb, but that he and his top commanders were going to be looking through the report, looking at all of these instances, seeing whether any of the information was new to them or not, and whether they warranted further investigation. Some of the egregious actions outlined in the report have already been investigated by the police department. And again, much of the information that the DOJ found came from the police department. So they had much of this information already.
And would this kind of thing be, would that requirement, as it were, to look into, to further investigate, identify the specific officers who committed these unconstitutional acts, would that be the kind of thing you would expect in a consent decree? Would the DOJ require it? And would a court-appointed monitor make sure it happened?
Not specific to the things outlined in the DOJ report. The DOJ came in specifically to address problems for the department as a whole on the civil side. They did not assess the criminal liability of any of the individual officers involved in any of the incidents outlined in the report. And I don't think it's the case that these sorts of reports have resulted in a large number of terminations elsewhere. What I think that the goal for the DOJ is to lay all the cards on the table, point to the systemic problems, and say, through the consent decree, you have to meet X, Y, and B benchmarks. Here's the threshold. Here are your priorities. And then the court-appointed monitor will come in and essentially be prescriptive. The monitor will say, well, to address this, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And that's really where we will better understand the price tag for this.
Yeah, and the department and the mayor have welcomed the DOJ. They, as you said, they shared information with them. Do you think folks in the department, from your reporting, understand a consent decree, this arrangement by which there is a court monitor appointed to make sure that the Baltimore Police Department does A, B, C, and D to address these problems? Do you think that's the best way? Do people understand this as the best way to have systemic change in the culture of the police department? Lynn Bowie from the Post in the last segment telling us that, you know, there's some evidence that that's happened in PG County. Is there a confidence level that consent decree is the way to go to make these changes happen?
I think there are a lot of different opinions. You know, we've heard from officers who say this is going to take the department in the wrong way. You can't just stop policing in some of these poor black neighborhoods because that's where the homicides are. That's where really bad crime occurs. There are others who say that this is just what we need. I talked to a lieutenant who said, I don't look at it as a bad report card. I look at it as a health checkup, that you're getting told what's wrong and then you can move forward and get the right medicine and do better. But I also think there are people on the street who are skeptical that this report will translate into sustained improvements in the police department. There are also others, like the Fraternal Order of Police, the union that represents rank-and-file officers, who say, we've been standing up shouting for some of these reforms for a long time. They put out a statement, I think it was yesterday, saying that the police department should do away with ComStat, which is the...
Which seems to fly in the face of everything the DOJ report said, because you know, collecting data, which is what ComStat does, is a linchpin of this.
And yeah. The FOP says that the problem with ComStat is it tracks arrest numbers and essentially creates a motive for officers to make a large number of arrests, which translates into
presents the wrong incentive. Yeah,
right, and then... Interesting. Stops for without cause.
All right. Well, you've done terrific reporting. I appreciate the reporting and your time this morning. Thanks so much.
Absolutely.
Kevin Rector is a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. I'm sorry we were not able to get in touch with Ben Jealous. We had some technical problems reaching him. He is on the road. But we are also grateful to Lynn Bowie of the Washington Post. We've got links to their outstanding reporting on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. For more on the DOJ report, tune in today to Midday with Sheila Cast at noon. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests this morning and every morning provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can find them online at zekescoffee.com. So that's it for us today. Coming up Monday, a conversation with Dr. Carla Hayden in her first interview since being confirmed by the Senate as the next Librarian of Congress. Plus, producer Bridget Armstrong reports from the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture on their new exhibition, and Dr. Lawrence Jackson on the legacy of Freddie Gray and inequality in Baltimore. All that, plus a theater review with Jaron Russett coming up Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's on the way with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great weekend.